Good morning, everybody. This is Dr. Clare speaking, and we're, as you know, this is a very new phenomenon, this podcast. So we're looking at different ways of how to present interesting material that will inform your, I mean, really your familiarity and context and why people find herbal medicine so unfamiliar, even though it is our medicine since prehistory. About 10 years ago, I asked the question, why was I not taught about herbal medicine when I was in medical school? And you're not going to believe it, guys, but this is the answer. This led myself and co-writer Tim Morrissey down rabbit holes, economic systems, political systems, social realities, industrialization, shipyards, economies, medicines, healing, cures. Now, I have to say that healing and cures were probably the least of it in terms of the influencing what is that's available to us. Because you recognize from that list that context is everything. The other thread throughout this book was follow the money. Without a doubt. I didn't go in with that perception. I went into medicine, you know, for security. I certainly wanted a good living. And that's actually very core to the book, is that doctors and herbalists and people, that medicine is always part of the economy and it's always part of the power structure. So I'm just going to fire straight ahead, and I'm going to do an introductory context and then read a few pages going back to the era of when witch hunts were part of the social makeup. So this brings us back to the late 1600s to the 1700s. Now, at this time, pharmacies, apothecaries, dispensaries, and world trade with the colonies was all caught up with products like Bateman's pectoral drops, Godfrey's cordials, and I think it's Dalby's carminative. Now, these all contained opium. These were available as drops for children for teething. And we all know from reading novels about the later popularity of laudanum, which was used for neurasthenia, which mainly affected women. Opium was available over the counter, on the shelves. Our latest encounter with OxyContin and pharmaceutical companies, they're just the latest iteration of having these things available to numb people. Pain is part of the human condition, and opium numbs pain, whether it's psychological pain and very definitely physical pain. So at this time, the materia medica is the body of remedial substances that are used in the practice of medicine. The turf wars in the early 1800s was demonstrable by the early 1800s. And at this time, if you looked at Rees's family dispensary, which is a bit like the British National Formulary or the list of the number of medicines on the databases on Google that are available also to pharmacists and doctors. I'm thinking about the electronic medicine database, that these kinds of databases would be the equivalent today. Rees's family dispensary had 60 medicines listed. Only 24 of these were plant-based. And of those 24, only 4 were homegrown. And this gives you the idea, again, of power and influence, because the further away that they came from distant colonies via shipping routes, the more expensive they were. And these were the things that were being sold and prescribed by doctors and pharmacists, apothecaries they would have been called at the time. The rest of the 60, 24 from 60, the rest of them were inorganic chemicals, even back in the 1800s. So our perception that the pharmaceutical industry is responsible for all ills really needs to be taken in context. Medicine has always been the subject of turf wars, money and influence. And it's the same in every system in the world. Every general systematic medical service has always had patronage if it's extended to the whole population. This could have been the Chidlocks, the chieftains, the Taoiseach in the chieftain system in Ireland and similarly in Scotland, whether it was the Rajas in India, whether it was the warlords in various places. But all systems of medicine have a patronage. We don't realize it, but the patronage, most patronage today, is actually through our public tax system. So incrementally, from this era of inorganic chemistry, the ecosystem of herbal medicine was diminished over centuries, right? So that today, if you look at the Materia Medica, I think you'd be hard put to find digoxin and colchicine are probably the two. One is a heart medicine and the other is a medicine used for gout. They would probably be the only two that are significantly still, and you, the Taxol for cancer treatment. And these would be the most immediately effective, demonstrably, that can be measured. Measurement comes into this to a great extent, especially as we move into the last 60 years of evidence-based medicine. But of course, we've used evidence-based medicine since medicine was first ingested, and particularly since the rationalization and systematic thinking of Hippocrates, and in Greece, Turkey, very close together, and in Avicenna in northern Africa. So that's just by way of giving an introduction, and I now read a section of the book. It might be a little bit dense, but bear with it. Hopefully that will be worth it. Okay, so feedback would be welcome. Let me know if this is a good medium or a good way to present things. So this is about witch hunts, lost traditions and social reconfigurations. Few social phenomena have had such varied representation and misrepresentation as what's been called witchcraft. The era of witch hunts spanned from the 14th to the 18th century. It had a decided peak in the decades either side of 1600. And this is sectioned off as an abstract obscurity in mainstream history. But in reality, it had major social implications, and particularly for traditional ways of life that had formerly included the widespread use of herbs in folk medicine. Because aside from the professional use of herbal medicine, folk medicines has always been part of community use before the doctor was called, and is still very, very present in the vast majority of the world. Estimates of the number killed through witch trials are hugely variable, from 60,000 to 100,000, or even more, based on looser extrapolations. The lower figure is predominantly based on official records, but as you can imagine, local kangaroo courts and extrajudicial killings occurred in an undocumented fashion. And particularly in later years of the witch hunts, the witch hunts were seen as being a judicial system. They involved official recognition from state and church. Most places were only documenting rudimentary statistics. So in periods of war, famine and disease, there's likely to have been a lot of missing data. And some data may have been deliberately suppressed by authoritative influences. So based on depictions and hearsay, herbalists of both sexes were described as witnesses, as witches by default, because they were doing things like boiling herbs in large pots, generally busying themselves with extracting medicines from nature. And their real crime is that they were non-affiliated. They subtly became negative features, were emphasized as a new set of aggressive denunciations, followed wider conquests and stoked tensions. So this was really about pitching groups of people against each other or against individuals and taking sides. Communities were invited to take a closer look at potentially accessible scapegoats for adverse circumstances they experienced. As things really took off, few calamities were without a ready supernatural explanation and involved some local suspect who was up to no good. In many communities, but certainly not all, and exceptions include Normandy, Estonia and Iceland. So this wasn't a global thing. Some communities were not involved at all. Mostly women were in the crosshairs. A major difference in emphasis developed between the use of the term wise woman or witches, as the former became the latter, who were previously sought for advice were now condemned. It wasn't that they changed anything that they did. That's very important. The simply social perceptions shifted around them, and we've seen that pattern much more widely throughout history. The use of the term translated as cunning folk that formerly widely applied in traditional communities around Europe implied a mixture of respect and fear, and people generally fear what they don't understand. The public were happy to benefit from occult or hidden knowledge, but also wary of crossing such people, male and female, who were widely perceived as powerful in their own fashion. And as we know, with knowledge comes power. These occurrences have often been portrayed as stemming from religious beliefs, but this characterization can be viewed as imposing more modern conceptual frameworks on what was a different language, a different landscape. At a more prosaic level is the notion that removing the main carriers of traditional knowledge was a priority for new conquerors, keen to erase the past and better mold a subjugated population who were left without their former thought leaders as cultural guides. I think that's worth thinking about, because I think there's a lot of that happening at the moment. We discredit the carriers of traditional knowledge if we want to bring in a new system and new cultural guides. We can think of the Cultural Revolution in China, but I can think of ones closer to home. In terms of more systemic aspects, an illustration of the bald consequences of a new imposed legal system is the early witchcraft case of a well-connected Hiberno-Norman noblewoman, Alice Keitler, in Ireland. She was found guilty in the Diocese of Kilkenny in 1324, but successfully fled the country while her young maidservant, Petronilla of Meath, who had been tortured before confessing, was deemed guilty as a co-conspirator and burnt at the stake. Now, this is interesting because it's an entirely new phenomenon which was completely divorced from the Gaelic cultural norms at the time, and it occurred in the wake of the Norman conquest. The Norman conquest in Ireland was mainly in Wexford and Waterford, which is at the crosshairs of Kilkenny. English rule and increased papal interference through the emerging powerful religious orders operating under capricious ecclesiastical laws. So this is when kind of fulcrums of history come together and become manifest as social drives that take off. This is me speaking. While Keitler may or may not have been involved in criminal acts, it's not unlikely that the wider context shows that a show trial was put on to reinforce the authority of the new religious hierarchy, in this case, the local bishop. Controlling society through the punishment of the few to guide the masses for benefit of another few can be anticipated, based on many precedents, before and since then. Some authors, like the historian Robert Briggs, have stridently emphasised the very localised elements of witch hunts, witch trials, and things like neighbour disputes as causal, pouring cold water on any wider functional slant, like the destruction of undesirable cultures in the process. That there is no singular explanation for the witch hunts can be understood without letting go of qui bono questions, that means who benefits, as Europe was a very different place before and after this extended period. An overlooked aspect was the combination of torture as a means of extracting evidence by confession and the use of this evidence in court proceedings that had the outward appearance of rationalism and justice. In his book The Witch Hunt in 2006, author Robert Thurston states, "On the whole, the European judicial system, especially outside of England, changed fundamentally in the High Middle Ages. Courts operated on the basis of reason and evidence more than ever before. Ironically, this new jurisprudence helped lead to a vast increase in charges of witchcraft. The new courts made the witch hunts in many places." So introducing reasoning, rational jurisprudence, which looks reasonable and fair, can often lead to unfair consequences, is the point of that. Did all this just happen of its own accord, or were there more serious intent behind these developments? The use of torture introduces a whole potential side to the phenomenon that involves accusations of basic thuggery dressed in officialdom. It does not require much imagination to think that those being tortured or threatened with torture knew the social conventions of the time, who knew would have been willing to say anything that would end their misery. It's notable that witch trials were either unknown or very rare over large tracts of Europe during this period and were focused in certain areas. The complexity of what actually occurred on the ground in such places is evident from the writing of historian Catherine Utz Tremp, who sees clear links between the former persecution of heretical sects and the early witch hunts in Switzerland, which was a hotbed of executions. A recurring theme is the assertion of social conformity at the expense of diverse traditions, under either explicit or implicit threats. In terms of broader social commentary, it would be in keeping with the desires and methods of the leading 20th century propagandists returned to later that the elderly in society in these countries, with all their lifetimes of care, knowledge and experience, would be deliberately targeted and their reputations shredded. As a segment of society, elderly women in particular have suffered subtle but real prejudice due to popular portrayals of witches as ugly and malevolent. Such figures in reality may often have been widows whose family had moved elsewhere or died and would have experienced much tragedy and struggles to survive as a result. Behind accusations of witchcraft lay potential grubby realities like local politics, rivalries between neighbours, thwarted love interests, jealousies, schemes to extract property and land, and desired removal of competition in terms of local civic authority and/or medical services. I challenge anybody to think that this isn't relevant to today's politics. So context is everything. In support of the argument that herbalist midwives, stroke midwives, were unduly targeted in coordinated fashion is the case of Agnes Sampson. She was a Scottish wise woman, humiliated and tortured before being strangled and burnt at the stake in 1951. Her case included the personal involvement of King James VI of Scotland, later James I of England, both a supposed target and judge, and was part of the infamous North Berwick witch trials. This particular episode was far from being a neighbourly dispute and was again likely all about delivering a direct and royal message to the broader community through instilling fear. The naming of co-conspirators during torture was a central component of widening the net. That was a much broader targeted set of action that may have seen some 3,000 to 4,000 accused witches executed in Scotland between 1560 and 1707. The theme of witch hunts continues throughout. The book is not necessarily in chronological order, so these features of isolating and new power systems and money and medicine recur throughout the book. So you can now see where today's association of facial warts and pointy hats discrediting women's knowledge and wisdom with age very specifically. Later in the book, I think this point is relevant, we also draw a lot of parallels between the witch hunts in the 1600s, 1700s, with the portrayal of quacks. Before that, the portrayal of heretics, we covered a little bit. And these were the Cathars, is the one having recently been to Carcassonne in that area. The Cathars, anybody who went back to a more simplistic life in the spiritual sense, became heretics. They didn't toe the line. And later in medicine, the portrayal of quacks has a lot in keeping with the isolation and power division that were manifest in the witch hunts, and the point that reason and rational is pitched against irrational, whereas the rationalization of the witch hunts made for more witch hunts that appeared more reasonable and appeared more rational. There is also the pitching of honest versus dishonest. So all of these opium patents, and the patents were not on the opium. The patents were on the shape of the bottle and the indentations in the bottle. So there have always been ways of patenting official medicines. Honest versus dishonest is not a good distinction between who is knowledgeable and what is safe and who is ethical and honest. So there's and who is dishonest. Conformist versus nonconformist is also a repeated theme. We're not very comfortable in a society with those who don't conform, and they make the first for the first line of scapegoats. Whether it's no matter what, if society is in a vulnerable state of upheaval, it will seek a scapegoat, and they tend to be people who are on the margins of society or reclusive. I think it was useful here to talk about the straw man argument, where the straw man argument, I had to read this several times because, again, this recurs throughout our analysis. And it's where you pick a tangent real part of an overall system of thinking, and you create an argument about this very small aspect in order to distract and avoid dealing with the main argument. Somebody gave a good example where their son came in and said, "Dad, I want to go to a film with my friends on Saturday, and I need, you know, €20. And Dad says, "Well, that sounds like great fun, but I don't know the film. I don't know these friends, and maybe we'll organize it later, or maybe you'll bring me more information, or your friends can come here first." All kinds of ways of framing this to say no, and giving the reasons why. And the son, teenage son, says, "Oh, no, you never want me to have friends." So this is just another example of how I'm not supposed to have friends. So it's taking a small part of a bigger answer and making justifications and arguments which you hope you will win. Dad was much too sensible to give in at this arena, but it just gives an example of a straw man argument. So if you're looking at analysing things, I have found that since learning about this, I have found it to be a very useful way as looking at whether somebody is presenting genuine reservations about a thought that I've had or a way of thinking. I have found it very useful, so it might be useful to you. It's also made me always look at who benefits, qui bono, who benefits if collaborative medicine is never presented. Right. Who benefits if we know nothing about the herbs in our environment? Who benefits if everything that we use for health has to be put through a system of evidence-based medicine, which is a very narrow band? OK, it's very useful. I love science. I love evidence. This would be who benefits if we don't have this knowledge and we don't make these connections? And who benefits if we are... if we don't trust nature, you know, if nature is something to be overcome and overwhelmed, like the big presentation is we are part of nature. We are in continuity with it. We were born from it. We will die within it. We will live our lives in close contact with it. So why would we not cherish those connections? Why would we not expand them? In a way that would enhance our experience. But instead, I think the industrial technical environment overly isolates us from our environment. So I hope that's useful. And we would love feedback on whether this is a good way of presenting things.
We look forward to you joining us on this journey of exploration and learning with the herbal doctor, Dr. Dheelaish Clare. And we'll be back with you very soon. So thank you very much, and stay tuned.